NTU World of Wisdom. Welcome to High Impact Thesis. In this podcast, we speak with researchers from various scientific fields to talk about the motivation, goal, and potential impact of their research. We also want to give you a sense of how a PhD is carried out with an emphasis on the PH, the philosophical aspects involved in pursuing a PhD.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to the HID podcast. Today, we have a very special guest, one of three special guests, in fact, Mohammed Ibrahim, which is one of the founders of this podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And our hosts today are Malik and
Ahmed Hussein.
So why don't we get right into it? So maybe we should mention that we'll ask you a little bit about the podcast towards the end, you know, when we go over your interests and everything.
Sure.
Just as an insight to students that want to set up something like this, you know, set up an activity in their school or in general. But for now, let's get into your research field. So, like, the broadest explanation you can give for your research field.
All right. So my PhD research in general was on perovskite solar cells. So these are a new kind of emerging photovoltaic technology. So I think it's helpful before I dive deep into that to first share some background to give you an idea about the landscape of the solar cell technologies that exist out there. So if we look at the solar cell technologies, we have mainly three generations of solar cells. So we have the first generation, early generation of solar cells, which mainly consists of silicon-based solar cells. So we have polycrystalline and monocrystalline silicon-based solar cells. So these are still, until now, they are the dominant type of solar cells in the market. And next after that came in the thin film solar cells, or the second generation of solar cells. So these are a little bit cheaper to produce, lower cost, and they're quite good in terms of performance and efficiency. So these include examples such as CIGS solar cells. So this stands for copper indium gallium arsenide, I think. Or selenide, sorry, CIGS, yeah. And then we have cadmium telluride-based solar cells. We have amorphous silicon. These are different from the crystalline silicon solar cells. Then after that came in the third generation of solar cells, which is basically includes things such as quantum dot sensitized solar cells and dye sensitized solar cells, a lot of different, also organic photovoltaics based on polymer materials, and perovskite solar cells. So the kind of solar cells that I've worked with belong to the third generation. They are the emerging kind of solar cells. So yeah, I'll be talking more about that in this episode.
Great.
Devices, yeah.
So with each generational leap, I'm imagining there's like a better performance, better efficiency.
Well, in terms of performance, not 100%, but in terms of reducing the cost, yes, definitely. So for example, the CIGS solar cells and the perovskite, they are much, much cheaper to produce compared to the older generations. So this is the main advantage, I think, on them. But for the perovskites, until now, they already achieved a really impressive efficiency that's on par with the traditional silicon-based solar cells. So they're really promising.
As well as cost, I imagine.
Of course, maybe you can produce them less than half of the cost of, silicon-based solar cells.
I see.
Yeah.
So the kind of solar cell that you can just buy off, like Alibaba or something, like what is that most likely to be?
Sure. So that's most likely to be either mono or polycrystalline silicon solar cells. So they are, like, I think they have more than 80% of the market share nowadays. Yeah. So it's most likely to be one of those two.
So still like first gen?
Yeah, still. They are the dominant in the market. Yeah.
And is there a reason why the other ones have not like come into?
I'm not sure about the real, about that, like the reason, and I can give you an idea about why is that the case. Yeah, not sure. Yeah.
All right. So you mentioned quantum dots.
Yeah.
And that makes me think of my research, which is like fluorescence and like spectroscopy and so on.
Sure.
So what's the, aren't quantum dots for like making or like generating light?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, quantum dots, they can be used for both, either for photo detection and solar cell application, like for absorbing light and generating some kind of electric current, either for photo detection or energy production. They can also be used for emission. So nowadays they're also employed in, for example, TVs, displays. They're quite good for that that kind of application. Yeah, there are many other applications for quantum dots as well.
Right. So this whole field is like analogous to either you're generating light or you're generating
light.
A signal.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Right, right.
And so, and what are quantum dots exactly?
All right. So quantum dots are materials. So basically, they are nanoscale dimensional semiconductors. So basically, you can imagine a spectrum where we have a bulk material, three-dimensional material. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we have a single molecule or an atom. Quantum dots fall somewhere in the middle. They are so basically, the main idea behind quantum dots is that they are so small in terms of size, like nanometer, single-digit nanometer size particles, that give them special properties due to the size, due to the quantum confinement effect. When electrons are trapped within a small scale material, they will show a certain behavior in terms of absorption and emission. So yeah, basically, by changing the size of a quantum dot, you can tune its property, the color it can emit, for example, or absorb, just by changing the size, not the material. Yeah.
So that seems pretty versatile. I know this is kind of adjacent to your field,
yeah.
But that seems pretty like a pretty good candidate, right?
Yeah, like for what application you're talking?
For any kind of like tunability, right?
Yeah, of course. That's the main advantage, I think, of quantum dots. Yeah, they're quite tunable.
And what property do they contribute to in terms of like solar cells?
Basically, absorbing light. Yeah, mainly absorbing light.
Mm.
Yeah, absorbing the light. Yeah, and also emission, of course, as in LED applications and TVs and so on. Yeah.
But for a solar cell, you would want the quantum dots to have absorption in a specific wavelength range, or
usually, yeah, usually you can't like have it absorb the entire spectrum like three-dimensional materials. Also, I'm not, don't quote me on that. I'm not an expert on quantum dots. Yeah,
sure. So, where do perovskites come in now?
All right. So, perovskites offer a wide variety of advantages. So we have first of all the cheap cost, the low cost of production. Beside that, the high efficiency. So in within one decade, perhaps 10 or 11 years, they already achieve the same efficiency that you get using silicon-based solar cells. So this is quite impressive. They offer low cost, high efficiency, and also tunability. You can also tune the absorption. For example, you can use them in conjunction with the silicon solar cell in a tandem device. So a tandem device contains multiple layers of materials that absorb light. And usually, you will have one material that absorb a certain spectrum, a certain range, and the other material will absorb another part of the spectrum. Yeah. So yeah, this is a general overview of perovskite devices.
And when you're talking about efficiency, either for first gen or third gen, like what are the kind of numbers you're?
All right. So I think for silicon-based devices, you can get above 20% efficiencies nowadays in the market. Especially for monocrystalline. Polycrystalline, you can also get 18 and above. You can easily get that. Now, third generation, I think they are in the teens, like 13, 14, 15, in this range. But perovskite, they already achieved, I think the record efficiency is around 25.7 up to this day. Actually, you can go online and if you Google NREL, best research cell efficiency chart, so you'll get an up-to-date chart which shows you the record efficiency for every type of solar cells, like across the last four decades. So you'll see the progression of each technology.
Yeah. Wow, that's a nice resource.
Yeah.
So what are perovskites as a material, like
okay.
compared to silicon
sure.
or quantum dots?
So, all right. So the name perovskite itself, it comes from the name of a Russian mineralogist. His name is Lev Perovsky. So so basically, he discovered described a natural mineral. It's mainly calcium titanate, I think. So this mineral has a certain structure or an arrangement of atoms that we refer to as perovskite structure. So basically, perovskite materials are the materials that have the same structure that we find in the natural mineral calcium titanate. So there are a wide variety of perovskite materials, but a certain subset of perovskite materials are suitable for applications in solar cells. So these are mainly, you can refer to them as organometallic halide perovskites to differentiate them from other types of perovskite materials.
So when you think of like silicon solar cells, right, they have a very narrow window where they absorb energy, like
electron energy, photon energy.
Right.
Yeah.
So with perovskites, you're saying they have better efficiency. So is that window like larger?
Sure. So basically they have, I mean, in terms of absorbing light, they have a very, we call it high extinction coefficient, how effectively the material absorb the incoming light. So they have a really good extinction or absorption coefficient across a wide range in the solar spectrum. And the band gap is tunable. You can change the band gap. Okay, I want this this material to absorb only below the blue color, for example, and ultraviolet. I want it to absorb all the way until the red color, for example. So it's tunable in that regard. I think silicon has a band gap. We'll talk more about that. Has a band gap of around 1.12, something like that, electron volt. However, perovskite materials generally have a band gap that starts from 1.55 or 1.5 all the way up to 2. You can tune it and increase it above 2 electron volt. So this is the unit used to measure the band gap. Yeah. I think this is a general idea. Also, they have, in terms of the attractive properties, they have good electron and hole transport. So they have a good mobility, electron and hole mobility, which is very important for solar cell applications. Yeah.
Right. I think that's a pretty good overview.
So then where do you come in this whole picture?
All right. So I think perhaps before I dive deeper into my own work, I think maybe it will be useful to give the listeners an idea or about the operation mechanism of solar cells, just to give them an idea.
Sure.
So basically in a perovskite solar cell, a typical perovskite device, you will have a perovskite layer, a material, mainly, as we talked about, a perovskite material, a thin layer of a perovskite material, which is sandwiched between two materials. One is called electron transport material, and the other one is called hole transport material. So
when, the hole transport in the bottom?
You can have both kind of arrangements. So that you can have the electron on the bottom, and then you can have the hole on the bottom. Both of them are viable. So the main thing, the incoming light will come and excite the electrons in the perovskite material from the valence band. So this is the energy level in which the electrons usually are present during, like to form the bonds. So they are present in the valence band. So the incoming light, if it is of a sufficient energy to excite the electron from the valence band to the conduction band, then an electron will be excited and it will go up to a higher energy level in the conduction band where it can move freely in the material. Now in the valence band, this vacancy created by the electron is referred to as a hole. It's a positively charged, fictitious entity. Yeah. And on the top, we have the negatively charged electron. So now, after generating an electron-hole pair, we need to extract them as quickly and as effectively as possible from the perovskite layer before they get lost. So basically, the electron transport material will... The electrons, after they're generated in the perovskite material, they will get transferred into the electron transport material, only the electrons, and the hole will be blocked. On the other side, on the other material, the hole will be extracted by the hole transport material, and the electrons will be blocked. So the main idea, we want to do that as fast as possible so that the electron will not recombine and get lost again. So our enemy number one in solar cell research is a process called non-radiative recombination, whereby the electrons generated, the electron hole pairs that are generated by the light recombine again. So this process is usually mediated by the presence of defect or trap states. So basically you have a conduction band, valence band. Valence band and conduction band. In the middle, there shouldn't be any state where an electron can occupy. It should be empty, a forbidden band. So what happens in actual materials is that there are a lot of defects. So the presence of these defects would usually introduce states within the band gap in the middle. So these will assist electrons to recombine back to the valence band if they are present at an excessive amount, like excessive amount within the material. So basically, a lot of people are trying to mitigate this issue of recombination. We call it non-radiative recombination. So basically, an electron will recombine without producing any visible light photon. So basically, the part of the research I've done was about trying to apply certain treatments or modification to the perovskite layer itself in order to modify its morphology. So basically, the morphology is something like the grain size. I'm not sure if you are familiar with this term. So basically, if you look at the perovskite material under a microscope or under a scanning electron microscope, you will be able to see that there are grains, like small grains that are connected together. So on the grain boundaries, usually what happens is that you have a high concentration of defects, which means a high concentration of traps that would assist in the loss and recombination of electrons. So basically, I've done a certain treatment and tried to increase the grain size, dramatically increase the grain size, and this would limit the density of the grain boundaries, will reduce the number of grain boundaries within the film itself. And so this will, in many ways, can help in limiting the recombination, and also facilitate electron extraction. So electrons will move easily without facing grain boundaries. So this is part of the research I've done.
And so when you're talking about surface defects, do you literally mean, like, if you look at in SEM, it just looks rough?
No. Surface defects, I'm talking about atomic level defects. So basically a missing molecule, a missing atom, an atom in a place where it shouldn't be, unsatisfied bond, like you have a dangling bonds, they call them. So in the surface you have bonds, then there's nothing. So there will be unsatisfied bonds, which might introduce trap states in certain cases, depending on the material and so on.
And these occur in otherwise crystalline arrangements, right? They're supposed to be perfect.
Yeah, usually in an ideal material, crystalline material will have a perfectly ordered atoms. But in reality, unfortunately, you will have defects. So.
And is there a cause, like an identified cause for this?
I think it primarily comes from the fabrication method, from the fabrication process. Like, I think it's largely unavoidable in a certain way. But people try to mitigate them by doing also passivation, where they try to like add certain dopant materials to satisfy those vacancies or to satisfy unsatisfied bonds, like to partially try to fix that issue. Yeah.
How effective is that?
I think generally speaking, it's quite effective. Like, people have tried different materials, and like generally speaking, if you look at the literature, it's widely applied. There is a wide variety of passivation strategies and methods. And generally speaking, they seem to be quite effective in improving the performance as well as the stability also.
So how big of a factor is recombination if you were to talk about, like, efficiency, for example?
It's really, really important, really big. Because like the majority of loss that happens is due to the non-radiative recombination. It's number one enemy. Yeah.
So if... Is it the case that you're down from 100 to, like...
So usually there is a theoretical limit for solar cells. I think for perovskites, they have done the calculations. I think it's somewhere around 31.5%, if I remember correctly. But now the efficiencies are like, people are getting 20s, 21. The record is 25.7. So we still have some room for improvement. So the majority of that loss is due to recombination, yeah, non-radiative recombination.
Do you have any idea where that theoretical limit comes from?
I think they have done calculations based on the band gap of the material mainly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for silicon, you will have a certain theoretical limit. For perovskite, you might have a different theoretical limit. So yeah, there's a way to do calculations that are based on the solar spectrum of the sun that reached the Earth and the band gap of the material. So they can do certain analysis and come up with a number for that.
So that's like the maximum.
Yeah, efficiency. Theoretical possibility. Yeah.
Oh, so if it's limited by the solar spectrum, I guess there's no material that could, you know, have a pretty high efficiency because the solar spectrum is quite broad.
It's quite broad, yeah, but I'm not sure. Like you're trying to say, because the solar spectrum is limited.
It's quite broad, so
yeah.
It's very unlikely that there's a material that can take
Exactly.
Entire spectrum, yeah, right?
Exactly. So, for example, perovskites, they can absorb light up to, I think, 750 to 800 nanometer. So this is around red, above red, infrared. Yeah. Yeah. This is the maximum they can gain, like from 800 and then all the way to ultraviolet.
So isn't most of the energy in the ultraviolet region? From the sun, or is it the other way? Is it mostly in the IR?
Well, I think like the ultraviolet energy or the ultraviolet photons, they have higher energy. Yeah, that's right. But I think the majority of the solar spectrum leans toward the green and above. Yeah, like from the 500. Like if you look at the spectrum, you can check it out. You will see that the peak is around. In the green, 500, if I remember correctly, in this range.
So less energy, but more photons.
Yeah, more photons, exactly.
And at least in my research, I've come across detectors that go like really far into IR.
That's right. Yeah, there are a lot of people trying to work to develop IR detectors that go into mid and far infrared IR. Yeah. But they are using like, I think, two-dimensional materials, 2D materials to achieve that, yeah.
And those are not good for energy generation? Cause
no. Maybe they can assist in some ways, like to help us passivate or modify the interfaces, but as a light-absorbing material in themselves, no.
I see.
So passivation is one way. Is that what you're doing, or are you trying different things?
Basically, my work was mainly not on using certain chemicals to passivate the defects, but on modifying the morphology itself. So when we eliminate the grain boundaries, this would result usually in an improvement in performance, as I've mentioned, due to facilitation of electron and hole transport, and also limiting the recombination that might take place at the boundaries, if you have a lot of boundaries in the material.
And your approach to this was?
Okay, so basically I used a solvent. So basically I used a mixture of solvents, of two solvents. And then while preparing the perovskite material itself, we use a method called spin coating. We spin the perovskite material from a solution. So I forgot to mention, this is one of the big advantages of perovskite solar cells, is that you can fabricate them using solution-based methods, which are cheap. So this one more advantage. So yeah, back to the point. So after spin coating the perovskite material, I do certain treatment where I keep it enclosed within an atmosphere that's rich in the vapors of certain solvents, of a mixture of solvents. So basically, you can call it solvent vapor annealing, basically. So after you spin coat it, you put it in a hot plate to heat it for a while. And at the same time, I kept it within a solvent-rich environment. And so this would assist in the growth of larger crystals or larger grains. Yeah.
But you don't want grains.
No, no, larger grains mean less grain boundaries. So if you, in the same space, if you have larger grain, mean less grain boundaries, yeah.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Like reducing the contact
areas. Exactly, the contact areas between two grains.
I see. So where did this begin? Like, how did you get the idea to apply this method?
So there have been some works, like previously, using solvent vapor annealing. What I have done differently, like they have done some work on that, trying to do some morphology modifications. But what I have done is mainly use the mixture. So what I have done differently is I used you can call it an anti-solvent. So usually they use a solvent, a polar solvent. I use a mixture of a solvent, of a polar and non-polar solvent, both together, and modified the ratios to tune the morphology in different ways. So basically, this is the kind of thing I've done a little bit differently in this regard.
Mm.
So this is part of the research I've done. I've also done another part,
which you can talk about. Please, yeah, go on.
The second part was mainly I tried to develop a new approach or a new method to help us identify within a given perovskite device, to identify the sites or the location at which an excessive rate of recombination might be taking place within the device. So to do that, there is a method that's commonly used in solar cell research. It's called impedance spectroscopy. So this method, they use it to study the recombination process in the working perovskite device. So they, for example, put it under light and then do the measurement. It will give them a sense of the rate of recombinations. So you can use it, for example, to compare different treatments, like with a given treatment and without, and you can observe the change in the recombination rate. So basically, I applied this method. Usually people would illuminate the module, the solar cell, from one side and do the measurement. What I've done is I have done dual side characterization. Basically, I do the measurements when the solar cell is illuminated from this side, and then do another measurement when it's illuminated from the other side. So to do that, I had to prepare a special kind of device which have a semi-transparent top electrode. Usually it's not transparent. So I made a device which is transparent from both sides. And then when you do the characterization from both sides and do the comparison, then you can reveal some important information about the recombination process, which interface might be problematic, how does this material contribute to the performance or limit the performance, and so on. Yeah, this was another part of my research.
So is the single-sided method not accurate?
No, it's accurate. It's useful and accurate. It's widely used. But I tried to expand on that, to use it in a different way that might reveal more information.
And if you were measuring the same cell from the front or the back side, it's the same.
You might notice some differences. And right. That's the useful part. So if you see differences, okay. So I have an idea, maybe this interface is more problematic. We need to do more work to improve this particular interface, to passivate it, to do some interface engineering, they call it sometimes. Yeah.
And you want both sides to be
as good as possible.
I see.
Because usually the majority of the loss takes place within the interfaces, the majority of the loss, especially in perovskite devices. So we have losses within the bulk of the perovskite material itself, and we have losses that take place at the interfaces between the perovskite and the transport material, electron or hole transport material.
And once you identify a problematic area, and I'm guessing this is on the scale of, you know, atoms or so on.
You basically don't identify an area. You identify the interface. Okay, the interface between the perovskite material and this material, let's say titanium oxide, is problematic. We need to do some more engineering and some work to try to improve it.
Oh, the interface as a whole.
As a whole, exactly.
I see.
Yeah.
So the next time you make another cell, you would manage that.
You'll try to manage that and do some interfacial engineering and improve the
And so I'm guessing you have multiple interfaces in one cell?
Yeah. So basically you have mainly two important interfaces, generally speaking. You have the perovskite and the interface between the perovskite and the electron transport material as well as between the perovskite and the hole transport material. These are the main interfaces that govern the performance of the device. Yeah, but usually, yeah, you have extra layers. You have the gold on top. You have an FTO, transparent conducting oxide, on the bottom. But these are the two main interfaces.
The other ones don't affect your...
Yeah, they are not problematic as the perovskite interfaces. Yeah.
Right. So can you talk more about the actual method? Like, what are you probing for, and what do you, like, what's your output once you put your cell inside?
Like you're talking about this dual side characterization?
Yes.
All right. So basically, I mean, the main idea is that when you illuminate the device from one side, let's call it the electron transport material side. Okay. So you will have the performance or the rate of recombination primarily governed by the interface between the electron transport material and the perovskite, because it's near to the incoming light. Because as you go into the perovskite material, the absorption decays exponentially. So the majority of photocarrier or the hole pair generation takes place near the interface. So if you characterize it from this side and then using impedance spectroscopy, and for the sake of explaining things, let's assume that you got a value of recombination value or recombination rate of 100, for example. Do the same measurement on the other side, on the hole transport material side, and you get... So basically, if the hole transport material, the other side, is more defective, more recombination will take place. So basically, you will need to increase the light more to achieve the same power output you got from the electron transport material, because this interface causes more losses. So when you do the measurement from this side and from this side under the same output, you can probe the difference in the recombination rate from the two interfaces. You can see it, you can visually see it in the output of the impedance spectroscopy. Yeah.
And so is recombination, I'm guessing there are other factors at play to the efficiency that you get, right? Like you shine your light and you get an output,
mm-hmm.
but that's dependent on multiple factors, not just recombination, right?
Of course, yeah. Like the band gap of the material, the hole and electron transport mobilities in the perovskite material and in the electron and hole transport material. So a lot of factors come into play.
So you need to have isolated all of these other factors beforehand?
Not really. I mean, not really. They have an effect, but like generally speaking, the interfaces are the main critical bottleneck or main critical problem that we need to work out. Yeah, I understand what you're trying to say, but their effect is not as important or as significant as the recombination of the interfaces.
I see. And can you use the same testing method, like dual-sided testing method, for other like commercial cells?
Should be applicable, yeah. Should be applicable.
Before they're like, you know, completely packaged.
No. You do the characterization on a complete device. Yeah. So this is one of the advantages of this approach, is that you fabricate the entire device, you put it under light, under realistic operation conditions, more or less, and do the characterization so it will reflect the behavior of the device more accurately. Yeah.
So where along your research kind of project did you decide, like, hey, we need a better testing method? Like, how do you come about that?
Well, generally speaking, I was trying to do some work on semi-transparent devices. Like my supervisor like suggested an idea, specific research idea that we can do, and this slowly, a bit by bit, evolved into the kind of research that I ended up doing at the end. Like, I didn't think of the method from the beginning. Only after I made the semi-transparent device and thought, oh, okay, maybe we can do this, and then started doing the experiments and simulations and all of that to achieve it.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So did you actually then go on to improve those
yeah, so
issues, or you just stopped at...
I only mainly focused on developing and applying the method. So I developed it, like did some simulations to as a proof of concept. And then I went and experimentally applied this characterization on multiple device structures.
So while we're talking about testing, another question that might come up is when you're testing in a lab, your light source might be different from the actual real-life solar spectrum, right? So how do you make sure the two are comparable? Because at the end of the day, your solar cell has to go into the real world.
Yeah, that's right. So generally, we use solar simulators. So these are special lamps that simulate the solar spectrum, nearly exactly like they simulate the... They use xenon lamps. They are quite good at helping us simulate the solar spectrum. Yeah. So it's a standard, they call it 1.5G illumination. 1.5 AM illumination. So this is the solar spectrum that reached the Earth's surface, because it's different from the one that's in the outer space, for example.
Yeah, that's another question I had. So is the efficiency higher in space? I would imagine so.
You'll have more of the solar spectrum to absorb and convert into energy. So I'd imagine so, yeah.
But can we also simulate that spectrum?
Not sure about that. If any, not sure actually.
Because actually, that's another question I had, which is where is the majority of solar cells used? Are they used in power generation on land or in space? Because all satellites.
All satellites they have solar cells, but I think they're on Earth. I think the majority of the solar cells used now are on Earth.
Is it not an issue, or is the development pathway not different for the two, for a space application versus a land application?
It might be a little bit different. Like you try to consider things like the high ultraviolet radiations and how to protect your solar cell from that and so on. Yeah, there might be some different considerations. Yeah, but in terms of the operation mechanism and efficiency, I think it's quite similar.
So if we go back to the practical aspects of perovskites, right, as a whole or with your method, I think one of the biggest challenges in like operational solar cells is they get dirty, right? They have a lot of dust on them or something.
This is an issue, I think, yeah. The dust accumulation on the surface is one issue, but I'm not sure how people are trying to to overcome that that problem. I think cleaning, mainly, people are trying, I think, to develop automated cleaning or something like that to help streamline the process.
Right, but as a material, if you were to coat it with something like a hydrophobic coating, right, does that now mess up the previous stuff you were doing with the solvents and the spin coating and everything?
No, usually when, like, if you envision the final product, you'll have something that's encapsulated and protected from the external environment, ideally. So it's usually encapsulated, should be encapsulated, at least for perovskite. They must be encapsulated because, they're quite sensitive to the external environment.
Right. So if you had some sort of external, like shock even, they wouldn't mess up the internal...
Shock like physical...
Yeah, like mechanical shock.
It shouldn't.
Or like high energy...
It shouldn't affect, no. I don't think it should have any impact on the device.
Right.
So anything else regarding your work that we have not covered so far?
I think we have covered everything.
Okay.
Pretty much everything.
So now I want to ask about where is this going, the future. Is there, for example, a Gen 4 of solar cells with new materials coming?
I'm not sure. I think perovskites are the most new thing, the most, like, the latest kind of technology that came in. But I don't. I'm not sure if there is anything else aside perovskites. Yeah, not sure at this moment. But who knows? Maybe in the future, we'll find new materials that are stable and better than perovskites, and that would be a good thing.
Yeah. So there's still potential for.
Yeah, there is potential, but if you think about perovskites nowadays, there are still issues to be resolved. For example, before we can commercialize them, a lot of issues still. So perhaps maybe I can share a couple of them. So one issue is the stability. So this number, I think it's not, it should be number one issue with perovskites, the stability.
What do you mean by stability?
Yeah, sure. So basically under the exposure of external stressors, perovskites would start to degrade and the performance will start to go down dramatically. So by stressors, I mean things like oxygen and moisture. Like number one, oxygen, moisture. And we have also elevated temperatures and extended or prolonged illumination, exposure to light for a long, long time, that would also cause device degradation and loss in performance. So these are some outstanding issues to be resolved. With regards to the oxygen and moisture issue, I think it's manageable using proper encapsulation, where you completely encapsulate the device and protect it from the external environment. Now, the issue remaining is to try to deal with the temperature stability problem. Like at elevated temperature, will the device still maintain its performance or not for extended operation? Also, under illumination for long hours, long time, like years or months, will it still maintain its performance or not? So these are some issues to be resolved. I think the second issue, in order to upscale their production and commercialize them, is to try to develop, to fabricate devices or solar cell modules, like large scale devices. So basically in a research solar cell, like in the laboratories, they are very tiny, like the active area is around 0.1 centimeter square. It's quite small. So we have to find a way to scale up their production. So the method we use for fabrication is spin coating. Spin coating is only applicable if your device is small, because in a large area, you need the entire layer to be uniform, very uniform, but that's not the case in spin coating. So people need to figure out a way to fabricate devices at a large scale, large size, that are also efficient at the same time. So yeah, I think there are a lot of groups around the world who are trying to achieve that. I think including here, like in NTU, like in 2020, I guess, like they broke a record in terms of large solar cell. I think it was 21 centimeter square, the size of the module, with an 18.1 efficiency or something like that. So it's quite impressive. So yeah, people are doing great work in that regard, I think. Yeah.
And so one of the factors you mentioned is prolonged operation,
yeah,
right? Or temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Does this tie back into higher recombination rate?
Of course, like after the device starts to degrade with time and under exposure to these stressors, it's normal that the recombination will start to increase, and the performance will go down dramatically.
So what is that degradation specifically? Like if it's been under illumination for years, like...
Basically, yeah, so there are some chemical instability issues. For example, there is a... I think something that happens quite often with perovskites is ion migration. So the ions, they'll start move around. And they, for example, will accumulate at the interface or cause some chemical reaction, or ions from the metal electrode will start to migrate into the perovskite and cause a lot of trouble and issues, or introduce new defects and accelerate recombination and things like that.
And these stability issues, I'm guessing, are not present in first-gen devices?
Yeah, I think silicon devices are quite stable. Like they can, I think the lifetime of a silicon solar cell is typically 25 years or something like that. Like tens of years. Yeah.
So that's one issue, stability.
One issue. And the second issue, as I mentioned, is the trying to upscale their fabrication into larger devices. Yeah. Large solar cells.
Right.
Is that purely a manufacturing issue?
More or less, I think, yeah. Yeah, trying to develop a method that's compatible with large-scale production. Because yeah.
Right.
Spin coating is not viable for that.
And what about their energy production capability? Do you see a future where cities rely only, let's say, on renewable energy? Because what I heard recently was that it seems kind of a very hard thing to achieve because of all the materials we need to build all these, like solar cells and...
Yeah, I think also...
Power converters. Yeah.
That's right. I think, yeah, also one of the issues, I think, is the aesthetic aspect of solar cells. Some people talk about that. And then another issue is the space they need. But I think in the future, people are moving toward renewable energies. So I think it's inevitable to see some increase in the adoption of solar cells, yeah, around the world. I believe so.
Hmm. Because
yeah.
You're saying these perovskite materials are cheaper.
Cheaper,
and therefore,
yeah.
But can we then you know, rely on them completely?
Well, if they prove themselves to be like stable and viable and effective and efficient and low cost, so if you can obtain low cost per watt produced or low cost per unit energy produced, then I think they can be economically viable and applied on a large scale. Why not? Mm. Yeah.
And people are working on these issues, right? The stability and the scaling.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I think there are also some startups. There are
improvements.
Yeah, yeah, there are some startups actually trying to commercialize perovskite solar cells. For example, I think there is one in the US. There are two. One called Swift Solar. They are trying to build flexible perovskite solar cells. This is one advantage also. You can make flexible devices that are wearable, or you can use them for applications that need flexible devices. So there is Swift Solar. There is another one called, I think, Tandem PV. They're trying to use perovskites in conjunction with silicon solar cells to build tandem devices, they call them. I think there in the UK there is one called Oxford PV as well. They are trying to also apply perovskites in tandem devices.
Yeah. I think another really big consideration for like large scale application of these like newer technologies is, what is the end of life for something like this, right?
Exactly.
So once your perovskite solar cell is done, you know, it's degraded, what happens to it? Like, how do you dispose of it?
Exactly. One more issue for you. So the one of the biggest issues with perovskites is that they contain lead, which is a toxic heavy metal. So this is another concern regarding to the environment and health and so on. So we need to find out how we will perhaps develop standard ways of disposing these materials or recycling them somehow and using them again to make solar cells. So there are a lot of work needed to do that, yeah.
So this is like a whole other research area.
Other research direction, yeah. It's active, actually. Also, people are trying to use perovskite materials that do not contain any lead in them. Yeah, this is another active area of research as well.
And these can't be easily repurposed in any way?
Which one? The lead-free?
Or, like, the normal ones are the ones with lead, right?
Yeah. Usually the one that give good efficiency, top efficiency, has lead.
Right.
This is a theme that you will find a lot in material science. Cadmium and lead, yeah, they're present also in quantum dots as well. Lead and cadmium.
Right, right. So was there any kind of research that you came across, you know, just by chance, of how to like repurpose perovskite cells?
I think I came across one research done by a group. I think they tried to recycle the perovskite material itself and use it again to fabricate the same perovskite device, and they obtained a good efficiency, like even after repurposing the same materials. So I think it's viable, yeah. Yeah, it's viable, but we need to at least develop some standard methods to do this in a large scale, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Probably the recycling would probably be the easiest, right? Like plastic recycling, where you just use it to make it again,
exactly.
Right. Anything else you would like to share?
Yeah, I think that's it. I don't have anything in mind now. I think we've pretty much covered everything we covered.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting topic with pretty substantial implications, right?
Yeah, sure.
Energy generation is a huge issue moving forward.
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay, so because you are one of the founders of this podcast, I thought it would be interesting to probe your mind about that. Were you part of any other societies or like activities as a postgrad?
No, I would say the HIT podcast is the main thing for me. Yeah, I haven't been part of any like activities or clubs or anything like that.
Right, and we'll ask the other two founders as well. But how did this podcast, like, how did the idea come around, and how did you guys like move it forward?
Well, initially we used to come every once in a while, every Wednesday, chat about different topics and discuss different things. But bit by bit, we thought, maybe we can start making a podcast about this. Why, like, we're having a good conversation, why not record it, yeah? So we had the idea, slowly we started thinking and brainstorming different idea, how we can run this this podcast, how would we structure the conversations, how we can manage to get and attract the guests and so on. So slow, bit by bit, we started, brainstorming and testing and trying different ideas. And slowly, we managed to start it, yeah.
And what was the, and you can comment on this because you're also one of the founders. So what was NTU's response to you wanting to do something like this? Because as far as I know, there is no other like student-led university-wide podcast, right, at this moment.
Right. It's actually something we looked into, right? Like when we had the idea, we looked into who is NTU, is in NTU is doing this. I think we found a couple. They were just personal podcasts, like students from NTU doing their own podcasts. But it was not like a student initiative. NTU was very welcoming. Yeah, we had no issues
with
the support. Yeah.
And initially, you guys were here in Yunnan Corner.
Yeah, same room, same place.
just talking for an hour.
Yeah.
Beyond that, if any other postgrad student wanted to get into like an activity like this, not necessarily a podcast, but like something they do with their friends and they wanted to take it forward, do you have any advice or anything that you kind of noticed you would have done differently?
I mean, I can't think of any. I think sometimes you just need to brainstorm ideas and get input from people who might have some experience doing something similar, perhaps. Yeah, I think brainstorming, asking people for ideas and suggestions and tips and so on. I think that's all what I can say, yeah.
And now that you've graduated,
where
would you like to see this podcast in like a couple years?
Well, definitely I would like to see it continuing and getting new guests, perhaps from other universities, other research institutions, perhaps. There are a lot of them in Singapore, perhaps having guests from outside Singapore. So I'd like to see that in the future, definitely.
So the final thing we usually go over is your personal interests throughout your PhD journey, right? Like, what was it like when you got here? What did you do to keep yourself busy apart from just going to the lab?
Well, apart from going to the lab, I think the podcast was something outside my research life that I enjoyed doing very much. Besides that, usually, I like to meet my friends, some friends, to play cards, play board games a lot in the weekends. Also going for football games, and by myself. Sometimes I go for a run or a long walk to help me de-stress. What else? Language learning, also something I enjoy very much. I think that's it. That's it, pretty much.
Which languages?
Well, mainly Spanish. Spanish. I've been involved in that, Spanish mainly, but French. I'm also interested in French as well lately. Yeah.
That's nice.
Mm. All right, Mohammed Ibrahim. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. Research. It was really good talking to you all.
And we'll see everyone next time.